The big news in Indonesia this week is actually not the tsunami at all. It's the decommissioning of weapons by the rebel movement GAM and the withdrawal of government troops from Aceh. You know, there's been a 30-year war raging in Aceh, which is the northernmost province of Sumatra. And although there have been peace agreements before, so far the peace is holding. Troops are being withdrawn, and rebels are coming forward with their arms. There is a small monitoring force there from the European Union and ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, are keeping track of what's going on. So the prospects so far, at least on the peace front, are quite good. On the tsunami front, it's something else. A little bit about Aceh, though, first. Aceh has been well known since medieval times. It's a province which has been isolated from much of Sumatra, certainly Java, and the capital, Jakarta. The people are fiercely independent. Aceh is also the only province in Indonesia where Sharia law, or traditional Islamic law, is practiced. Indonesia, of course, is the fourth most populous country in the world, and it's the world's most populous Muslim country. But it's only in Aceh where Sharia law is practiced. A word about my own involvement in all this. Like many of you, I watched the tsunami unfold on television. I mean, these days, with the media being as organized as they are, and with tourists, which could well have been some of you here, lying on the beaches of Southeast Asia during our winter months, with video cameras, tourist video cameras, just regular video cameras that you can buy in London Drugs, which are state of the art, it was possible for us to see what was going on almost in real time. And I was fascinated, I was devastated by what I was seeing. Some of my former colleagues were posted in Indonesia, in Sri Lanka, in Somalia. So I was obviously concerned, and so concerned that I, in fact, 6 weeks after the tsunami hit, I did, as Diane said in her introduction, give a talk about the seriousness of it at SAGPA. Little did I know that out of the blue, on the 31st of March, I got a phone call asking me if I would urgently go to Indonesia. It wasn't that my colleagues had been listening to what I was saying at SAGPA, but nevertheless, the call came. And within 4 days, in fact, I was on a plane on my way down to Jakarta, which is pretty good for the UN these days. You know, everybody complains about the UN, except me. I'm one of the harshest critics of the UN. But we've improved in terms of our recruitment procedures. It was possible to get a medical done, to sign all the forms, to re-sign a pledge of allegiance to the UN, which you can do by email these days, and get on a plane and get down to the, in this case, affected area. My task, what I'd been asked to do, was to help restructure what essentially was a relief operation in Aceh. But a couple of days before the call came, which prompted the urgency of it, there'd been a massive earthquake on the island of Nias, which is about 400 kilometers southwest of Aceh. And I was asked, in fact, to coordinate the effort, the relief effort for Nias first, before moving on to restructuring the Aceh operation. But then as I was doing the Aceh operation, some of the world's top seismologists, a very famous Icelandic geophysicist, and a group from the University of Ulster in Northern Ireland, were predicting that there was going to be another major earthquake and tsunami off the coast of West Sumatra, which is about 1,000 kilometers southwest of Aceh. Sumatra, of course, where all this, which is the scene of all these events, is an enormous island. It's a good, 1,800 kilometers long, and that's only a quarter of Indonesia. It's a very, very big, long country straddling the equator and going all the way from Burma across through to Australia. So I'm going to talk first, that was what I was asked to do. I'm going to talk first about Nias. It's a small island, approximately the size of Bali, for those of you that have been to Bali, and it's just as beautiful. The UN and the NGO response there, the speed of response, was something that I, as an aid worker, could be particularly proud of. We were there the next day, not just with people, but by helicopters, with relief supplies, with medical teams, with doctors, with nurses, and we carried relief supplies in, and we moved the injured out. So you can't get much faster than that. And one, of course, wonders that if we could do it sort of halfway around the world, operating in third world conditions, why is it that it took so long to respond to Hurricane Katrina? Many different reasons. But the speed of response on Nias was excellent. We were only able to do that, however, because there was an ongoing operation in Aceh, just 400 kilometers away. And of course, we diverted our assets, our helicopters, our landing craft, our food, our water, our tents, our doctors and nurses from that operation to respond to the one 400 k's away. The physical infrastructure, which I'll show you in the slides, was very badly damaged. The whole island actually was tilted up on one side. It was an 8.7 earthquake offshore. No tsunami, however, and that's quite interesting. No tsunami followed that earthquake. But roads, bridges, ports, schools, hospitals, and thousands of houses were destroyed. And as I say, the whole island was tilted. The western side of the island ended up at least 6 or 8 feet higher than it was before the earthquake, leaving coral reefs out in the open, and the small fishing ports there high and dry. And it's still that way. But while the delivery of relief supplies couldn't have been faster, we, and I use the we in a collective sense, the relief community, the NGOs, the CARES, the Oxfams, the World Food Programme, the UNICEF, the World Health Organization, all those that respond to emergencies, we kind of did everything ourselves. We bypassed the government and just started administering succor to the people. Well, that's okay if you've got a gashed head or a broken arm or something like that, But it's certainly no good for the long term and the medium term. And often we went to the wrong places. And we helped people that weren't the most seriously affected because we rushed in and we didn't go through the, or at least consult with the government channels that that know things. There's a reason for that. One, of course, Indonesia is well known to be bureaucratic and corrupt. But nevertheless, you really shouldn't sidestep the government. You've got to bring them into the effort. There are all sorts of problems if one doesn't do that. Now that problem has been sorted out. That was in fact the first problem I had to address. That's sorted out, but what remains is a massive reconstruction job. Roads, bridges, ports, hospitals, schools, government buildings, the works. Now I'll move on to Aceh, which you will have seen, many of you, on TV. I want to say, though, that the scenes that I had seen before going, the scenes of devastation, in fact, are not as vast as they appear. Most of the damage, most of the devastation, was actually caused along the coastline, within 1 or 2 kilometers, and often a few hundred yards only, of the coast. And in that area, I mean up to 2 kilometers, there was total devastation. But Bandar Aceh, for example, which is the capital of Aceh province, is a town of 400,000 people, and just about a quarter of it was affected, but very badly affected. But that's 100,000 people. So, you know, I don't mean in any way to downgrade the scale or the seriousness of the disaster, but it's not all devastation. The official figure for the death toll in Indonesia is now 166,000. That's dead and missing, and within that figure is something like 20,000 missing. And they'll, in all likelihood, never ever be found. And don't confuse that with the overall death toll, because although Indonesia was the worst affected, the tsunami hit 11 countries in total. Sri Lanka was also badly affected, was the second most badly affected area. India, also seriously affected, southern part of Tamil Nadu. The Maldives, and then right across the Indian Ocean to the coast of Africa, to Tanzania and to Somalia and Kenya. Also to the north. Yemen also had a little bit of damage. But although 166,000 people are unaccounted for, dead or missing, 500,000 survivors are totally displaced. And then on top of that, you've got another 1 million people who perhaps were not directly affected in as much as they lost one of a family member, but a cousin, an aunt, an uncle, a nephew, and then the displaced, of course, like we over here would do if something like that happened, moved in with family and friends. So 166,000 dead or missing, 500,000 displaced, and another 1 million people affected in one way or another. But I'll show you also a slide of Chalang. It's okay to say that, well, only a quarter of Bandar Aceh was destroyed. Chalang, which is about 20 minutes by helicopter down the coast, 90% was destroyed. Small place, 1,200 people, just totally destroyed. Aceh's economy is agricultural. The people are farmers and fishermen. Fortunately, rice is the staple crop, and Aceh is self-sufficient in rice. But fortunately, the crop was not badly affected, although there was saltwater intrusion in the paddies that were close to the coast. And that's really important, because we perhaps wouldn't have the results that we have had over there if the standing crop had been badly affected too. However, of course, those survivors of the tsunami, about 500,000, lost everything, including their income. So although the rice was there in the fields, growing, and in the markets, the people had no money to buy it. Consequently, they've been on, or many of them have been on, free food from the World Food Programme principally, but and others, since the tsunami hit. And until they get jobs, until there is an alternative income, obviously that has to continue. Contrast that with a situation though in Niger, where you've seen most recently little skeletal kids dying of starvation, of malnutrition, basically because there's no free food distribution over there. And my task over there was actually to wean as many people as possible off free food, to let the market resume its normal role, and to get jobs for the people so they had an income and that they could buy their requirements instead of surviving on food aid. Farmers and fishermen. Well, the fishermen probably fared worse than the farmers, because 60% of Aceh's fishing fleet of about 10,000 boats never came back to harbour. They were just washed away. So the industry was decimated, and that is still a major problem. Although I'll say a bit more about that later. Now, 8 months on, most of the survivors, 58% in fact, are still living with family and friends, and their patience is wearing pretty thin. 30% are in tents, and most of those tents are now in tatters. Many of the tents that were sent were totally the wrong type of tent. They were the sort of tents we use over here when we go camping. Well, in 100-degree temperature, you know, sort of with camps of perhaps a couple of thousand, 3,000 people, you can imagine that is not the right type of temporary accommodation, but it's better than nothing. 10% of the population are living in temporary living centres, TLCs, which were constructed by the government within a month or so of the tsunami hitting. And these are the long barrack-like structures, which some people call internment camps, although there's no barbed wire. You can go in and out at will. But tiny 12 by 12 foot room off a long open corridor is where a family of 5 or 10 or more than 10 just have to live. They get their food free, they get their water, there's quite a bit of graft and corruption going on, but nevertheless, that's where people are living. And we'll show you some shots of those. Of course, one of the problems with this is that with hundreds of soldiers, both from Indonesia and from various countries that were the first to come in with their helicopters and save people, and their landing crafts and their naval vessels. The place was awash with soldiers within a week anyway. And then, after those soldiers, the thousands of truck drivers, as relief supplies started arriving by trucks, you can imagine that the AIDS problem in Aceh is really quite serious. People have nothing to do except breed. Family planning is a big problem, officially accepted but not practiced. And soldiers and truck drivers who are often responsible for large transmission of HIV. So that's a problem. What do the people want to do? Well, I mean, all they want to do is now go back to where their homes or their villages once stood. They want to get on with their lives. They want jobs. And they want somewhere to live. And that is not happening as quickly as one would expect from the amounts, vast amounts of money, $7 billion in all for Indonesia, that the international community, yourselves included, have contributed. So why is that? One of the problems is that when the tsunami devastated much of the coastline of Aceh, it didn't just take the houses away, it took all of the possessions, including the title deeds to the houses. And as with any disaster, there are always speculators that rush in to make a killing. And whereas you may well have lost your house and can go back to where it once stood and say to the local authorities, this is where I live, there are half a dozen other people making the same claim. So an enormous problem. The other main reason is that it is well known in the donor community, the international donor community, governments, that Indonesia is one of the most corrupt countries in the world. And with this vast amount of money that was generated initially by the public, and then donor governments following suit because they were so embarrassed at how much their public were giving, thought, well, we better be careful on the way in which it's spent. We don't want half of it getting diverted. And Indonesia itself was certainly conscious about that. Therefore, it was careful in putting together a structure with checks and balances in it that could disburse the funds. And it wasn't until May of this year that an agency known as VRR was put together through which to channel all of this money. So those were the two main reasons for the delays. The first 6 months of the operation have therefore been a relief operation. And reconstruction has only been getting underway for the past couple of months. The contributions that went from the public, $213 million in Canada, contributed by the public, Canada's official contribution, that means through the government, $425 million, $213 million from the public on top of that. Over $6 a head in Lethbridge alone is pretty good. The public contributions, what you all gave, not what came out of your taxes, but what you all gave, went through NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and you have about 400 of them there. Some are excellent. Some, as you would imagine, are not so excellent. And some of them do not straight relief at all. There was one group handing out Bibles in Bandar Aceh Market Park that I saw there. But by and large, the NGOs did a good job, although they tended to take over operations, and the Indonesian authorities were sort of so fazed by the magnitude and the onslaught of foreign aid workers that they sort of stood back. I'm going to move on now to West Sumatra, which is where the world's leading seismologists are warning that the next tsunami could occur. It's about 800 kilometers south of Aceh, halfway down in the, Sumatra's west coast, for those of you that know Sumatra. What is happening is that the Sunda Trench, which extends from the Nicobar Islands of India in the north and runs right down along the west coast of Sumatra, is opening up. And there have been hundreds, I repeat, hundreds of large earthquakes since the big one on Boxing Day. In the just over 2 months that I was there, I must have been through a couple of dozen, over six on the Richter scale. You stop counting after a while. And the place is still rocking. In August, there have been 23 earthquakes between 5 and 6. So it's still rocking. So the Sunda Trench is opening up. And what is particularly worrisome is that the sea off the coast of West Sumatra is very deep. It's 2,000 meters deep. Whereas off Aceh, it's shallow. So with the deep water, the tsunami, the earthquake is always offshore, or almost always offshore. And if you've got deep water, it's got plenty of room to build up. The other major problem about West Sumatra, it's heavily populated. The Vice President of Indonesia had asked the UN to assess the state of disaster preparedness as soon as these warnings came out, and the task fell to me to go and do the assessment. And I was very worried with what I found. Although there had been disaster preparedness plans prepared for the capital, Padang, which is a city of 900,000 people, a bit smaller than Calgary, 600,000 of those 900,000 were considered at risk. They lived in low-lying area, which the tsunami would inundate if, in fact, it occurred. The other disturbing factor is that only 31 of Padang's buildings were considered earthquake and tsunami-proof and capable of accommodating about 30,000 people. So what about the other 570,000 people? Major, major problem. The other thing that was striking instantly was that the command and control center that had been set up was about 50 meters from the ocean and would have been the first thing to get washed away. So that's been relocated now. But as one went up the coast, as I did, by helicopter right up to the northern extremity and down to the southern extremity, dropping down where I wanted to, news of the possible earthquake, disaster preparedness, became less and less of what was on people's minds. And when you got to the end, well, there were no plans whatsoever. In some of the bigger towns, right on the coast, there had been glossy pamphlets prepared, which were generic and I suppose okay for VIPs, but totally useless as far as the population was concerned. They'd never get them anyway. Evacuation sites had been identified, but the land hadn't been cleared. And these were on higher ground. Obviously, tsunami comes in, you've got to get up high. But the land had not been prepared in advance. I mean, it hadn't even been leveled. The jungle hadn't been cut. So if the tsunami came, all you knew is you had to go up there, but you didn't know which way to get up there, and there would be a stampede, and people would get killed underfoot. So that wasn't good at all. Earthquake drill was happening in the high schools in Padang, the capital. And in fact, I'll show you a slide of one which I photographed the earthquake drill. And in the middle of the drill, there's a 6.3 earthquake. But that's just the capital. When you get out to the schools outside, no drills whatsoever. So, not surprisingly, people were panicking every time there was a major earthquake, just a tremor. And to this day, people are sleeping out at night. They go sleep in a tent on higher ground. And that, of course, if the tsunami hits during the day, you know, you stand a better chance, you can see where the hills are and off you go. But if it's in the middle of the night while you're asleep, which is true of earthquakes, true, the mortality is always higher. So they sleep out. Now, my recommendations, obviously, were to move the... I prepared a report. Here it is. Anybody wants to have a look at it, you're most welcome. It was presented to the Vice President, and the first thing said, move the command and control center and upgrade the radio equipment. Public awareness has to be improved immediately. You know, you have to involve the Red Cross. They have to hold meetings so that everyone knows what could happen, and if it did happen, where you should go. Involve the imams in the mosques on Friday prayers. You know, get the word out that way. Get the word out through the media. So that was accepted and implemented. Evacuation plans had to be, and maps, small maps, a one-page piece of paper, schematic with just arrows on it, showing you where you were supposed to go, had to be given to everyone. People need to know